Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Paranexus Universe. This is Doug Kelly. It is June 27th, 2008, and I'd like to welcome everybody here to tonight's program. We have an interesting guest, and we invite your call-ins. The number is there on your screen, 347-945-7799. Also invite you to join us in the chat room. If you've got questions, you can certainly write those out in the chat room. Love to hear from you tonight. We've got a very interesting topic. I think one that you're going to really enjoy if you're into paranormal research. We've got Ghost Excavator with John Sable. Let me tell you a little bit about John. John is a cultural anthropologist, historical archaeologist, actor, and ghost excavator. He has been participating in and supervising field investigations since high school. He has conducted archaeological research in England, Germany, Mexico, and the United States. He has done ethnographic field work in Chiapas State and in the Yucatan, Mexico. He's appeared in more than 25 films, including Dune, Conan the Destroyer, Rambo 2, Falcon and the Snowman, and the James Bond classic, License to Kill. He has also appeared in numerous TV series, documentaries, and educational TV. He has taught cultural anthropology in the Graduate School of the University of Guadalajara, Mexico, and in various colleges in Mexico City. He has conducted ghost excavations in Winchester, England, and in the United States at Gettysburg, Eastern State in Philadelphia, Rolling Hills in New York, throughout Pennsylvania, and at various locations in the cities of Knoxville, New Orleans, San Antonio, Santa Fe, and the Black Hills, South Dakota. He is the author of 6 books. His approach to hauntings is participant observation based on the application of peripatetic. Hello, everybody. This is Doug Kelly. We got dumped just at the beginning, so I'm not sure how much of what I said you heard, but I'm going to get our guest back on the line here tonight, John Sable. Give me a second, and I'll reintroduce John. Just went through a big old introduction for John. Not sure if you heard much of it. Here we go. Hey, John, you're back.
I
just went through a great introduction. We got dropped. So, hey.
I think the residual energies in the house are a little bit disturbed here.
Yeah, no kidding. Well, anyway, you know what, John Sable? Welcome to the program. It's great to have you here.
Greetings from sunny and very warm Pennsylvania. How about that?
Wow. I guess it is summertime, huh?
Yeah, it's summertime up here, but not like Florida, I guess.
Yeah, it's not too bad. I mean, It's bearable here. Just in case some of my stuff didn't go over, I just wanted to invite our listeners, if you'd like to call in and ask John questions throughout the program, the numbers are on your screen, 347-945-7799. And you can also ask questions in the chat room. We'd love to have you join us in there as well. I just want to do another brief overview of your bio, John. You're a cultural anthropologist, historical archaeologist, actor, and ghost excavator. You've done a lot of research in England, Germany, Mexico, United States, You've appeared in a lot of films, including Dune, Conan the Destroyer, Rambo 2, Falcon and the Snowman, and James Bond classic License to Kill. In addition to numerous TV series, documentaries, and educational TV, you're the author of 6 books, and you've got some great stuff to share tonight. I know I've been looking forward to this. You know, let's get this out of the way. A couple of things. Number one, Grant, sure, for our listeners, is on vacation this week and next, so he won't be with us. It'll just be me, myself, and I, along with John. But, John, let's get this out of the way. Today is your birthday. Happy birthday.
Thank you very much.
And tell us about your film career, some of the different things you've done, just briefly. We'll get that out of the way, and we'll get into your ghost excavation stuff.
Well, I started off as a on a dare to go to an audition for Dune, and I got the role, and I spent like 4 months in production, and by the time I finished the movie, I was in the Actors Union. I had my own agent. I was I did 4 or 5 roles in Dune. I worked on the special effects on the worm for Dune. I did some dubbing and voiceovers for there, and from there I went into more movies. I had a really great agent when I was in Mexico working, and every script that came down to Mexico went through her, and I got a chance to audition for all the movies that came down, and most of them I got roles in. So that's how it started. It just blossomed into that, and then actually I had to give it up. I had to come back to the States due to a medical emergency in the family. I was an only child, and both my parents were dying, so I was right in the middle of shooting a movie in Zacatecas in the mountains of Mexico. I got a call to come back, so I came back, gave it all up, and I came back to the States, and I've been back ever since.
Well, that sounds pretty exciting, man. All right, so you've got some interesting approaches to paranormal research. Tell us about that.
Yeah, I'll use all of my experience going back to when I was 10 or 11 years old. I've kind of integrated into this ball of theory. And my first book, Ghost Excavator, actually talks about 3 or 4 experiences I had when I was 10, 11, 12 years old, and they are described in that book. And based on those experiences, I've kind of developed my preliminary ideas about what I think hauntings are. What I really want to get out of the way to say initially is I think it's very, very important that the audience understand from my point of view that my perspective is everybody out there, we all are actors and archaeologists. So when I say I'm an actor and I say I'm an archaeologist, I'm not just speaking for myself, I'm speaking for everybody out there in the listening audience, because I believe that we're all actors and we're all archaeologists, and we're also all the ghosts within. We have qualities within ourselves, these performative qualities within ourselves that we can use in performance-based investigations, and these performance-based investigations we need to use in the field in order to interpret and to understand the manifestations that are occurring at these haunted locations. So I believe that we all perform in the theater, and all this theater is framed by culture. And all that's needed to perform in this theater is a body, the physical body. So I believe that the investigator himself is the primary and the principal tool of investigation, and I relegate all of this technological ghost tech stuff to the periphery, and I myself out there in the frame, in the forefront, doing what I have to do to try to understand what's going on and try to resonate with the, if it's an interactive entity, try to resonate with them for them to understand who I am, that I understand their culture, and I am a socially significant individual to them, and that they would communicate with me. So what we need then is this body, and we need a frame of space and time. And am I talking too fast?
No.
I get all involved
fine.
In all this. I get really
hey,
excited about it.
Hey, passion is a good thing. Keep going.
I believe, you know, in this frame of space and time, and the space, I believe, is very, very symmetrical. So there are multiple paths that are reoccurring at the same time in the same space. So that's a symmetrical space. And time, for me, is not linear or anything like that. It unfolds. The past unfolds continuously into the present, and we can understand that very easily within ourselves, because we are the ghost within. That is, we have memories of past experiences that we had maybe last year, 10 years ago, 20 years ago, and those are past concepts and past ideas that we present in the present when we think about them. So this is the same thing with my idea with hauntings, that these hauntings are recurring memories of what was once a physical human that is now relegated to a personality, but still exists. And the anomalies that we see at haunted locations are cultural anomalies. I call them cultural anomalies. And in order to understand these cultural anomalies, we have to use an ethnographic, anthropological approach and understand the culture in which these manifestations were originally occurring. And that's one approach that I use in order to understand what's going on at a haunted location.
Okay, that's very interesting. Now let's back up and let's explain some of that stuff you just said. Let's start with this. What do you consider a haunting to be, just in a kind of a nutshell?
A haunting is something from the past that is not dead, that is not completed, that is something that is recurring again, be it a residual memory, be it a place memory, be it an interactive entity, something that is still not completed from the past. And that not non-completed past is a cultural context. If it is an interactive entity, the entity is framing him or herself within the context of their culture. So what is manifesting is not necessarily a change. The process is the change in temperature, or the process is increase in electromagnetic fields, et cetera, et cetera. That's a process. But the actual elements and the actual manifestational elements that are occurring are cultural elements. So you got very, very specific cultural horizons that are manifesting, be it residual energy or be it interactive entity. These are cultural manifestations. So you've got certain sounds that are very, very specific to a specific culture. You've got certain smells that are very, very specific to a specific culture. And all of these things are manifesting, and we have to understand that perspective and separate the process from the manifestational elements that are occurring. And I focus on those manifestational elements, and I relegate the process to be recorded and measured by the equipment, which is in the periphery, which is in the background of the research, because I'm out there in the foreground doing all kind of ethnographic activities or target activities, using target objects in order for an interactive entity, for the interactive entity to understand that I am a member of their culture, I am part of their culture, and for that entity to communicate with me telepathically, because they don't have a voice box, to communicate with me telepathically using different cultural manifestations. Now, if we believe that that ghosts need energy to manifest, and that this is all that is needed, that they, if there's the energy there, that they will manifest, well, then we're missing a lot, because if that was the case, if you're on an investigative team, why, if maybe only one person is the focus of the manifestation, this one person senses this or sees this or hears these manifestations and the rest of the team doesn't. Now, why is that? Well, the reason why that is because we have to, that person is being socially identifiable by the entity, and the entity is willing to telepathically communicate with that individual and not with other individuals.
Okay, so let's so a haunting. You mentioned place haunting, which is residual. So in your estimation, in your perspective, a haunting could include residual activity. It could include an intelligent entity, correct?
Right.
Okay, so that's basically what I think many paranormal investigators understand. And then you mentioned cultural stuff. Are you talking about the culture of the entity?
Exactly. The
okay.
Now, we're not talking about contemporary culture. We're talking about, for example, I've written three books on Gettysburg. Now, in those three books, in the first book, I say that, one, Gettysburg may not be as haunted as people think it is, and two, Gettysburg might not even be haunted at all, as i.e. interactive presences. And so I give the reasoning in that in that book. It's book three. It's called Gettysburg Unearthed. In book four, which is Battlefield Hauntscape, I identify, in book three I identify why it may not be haunted, or why it may not be haunted as much as people think it is. And here I'm not talking about residual energies. Here I'm talking about interactive entities. that are occurring in. For the first 100 years from 1863 to 1963, there were maybe one or two incidences of what we call ghosts or hauntings at Gettysburg. Then all of a sudden in the 60s and 70s and 80s, you have this proliferation of all these occurrences of hauntings, sightings of ghosts, a lot of auditory experiences going on. People go out on a battlefield at night at Gettysburg, and they hear something, and immediately they say, "Oh, that has to. You're on a battlefield. This has to be the sounds of the Civil War." Well, first of all, has anybody done a solid soundscape analysis of the battlefield at night? And does anybody these ghost hunters, do they understand what acoustic shadow is? On July 2nd, 1863, Longstreet, along Longstreet's line of Confederate soldiers, he could not hear the sound of the battle all the way along his line because of the problems of acoustic shadow. So if General Longstreet in 1863 could not hear the sounds of the battle, how could a ghost hunter in 2007 or 2008 hear those same sounds when in 1863 you couldn't hear those sounds?
Okay, so what do you account for the activity then, the apparently recent activity or recent decades of at Gettysburg?
I don't want to identify individuals or books or practices. Now, one thing that is very, very prevalent I see at Gettysburg is what they call the investigation, tour investigation. What it is people take you on this tour of haunted locations, or they take you to a place where there is haunting supposedly going on, a building. They go in there and they say, okay, this is what's occurring in Gettysburg. This is what's also occurring in this particular house, okay? Then they say, this is the equipment we use to detect what's these haunting elements that are going on in this house. Then we say, this is how we use the equipment. Third, you go out and you use the equipment and see if you can pick up any hauntings. So these people who go on these tour investigations, one, they have never been in this house or in maybe out in the field. They are not acclimatized to the one work being out there at night. Two, they have not done a soundscape analysis, knowing about all the sounds that are going on out there. And 60% of supposedly all manifestational hauntings in Gettysburg are auditory. Well, there's nobody's done a soundscape analysis to determine a comparative. Okay, what's this sound as opposed to that sound? Is that a natural sound or is this a haunting sound? They have not done that. They have not been acclimatized to that. They are suggestibility factor is right there. You think this place is haunted because other people have sensed activity there. This is the equipment we use to get to detect a haunting. Number three, if any sound or anything that they see that is, they think is an anomaly, oh, it has to be a haunting because this is what people say occurs here. So it's self-perpetuating what's going on there.
So what you're saying then is the activity that people are picking up on is due to belief that there's activity there?
Yes. Now, from 1863 to 1963, Jack McLaughlin has a book called... he wrote a book, The Long Encampment, and right in the book it says, quote, something like this, that there has never been any sightings of ghosts at Gettysburg. So for the first 100 years of Gettysburg's history of tourist activity, of people visiting the battlefield, there's been maybe only one or two accounts from the 1880s of something paranormal occurring at Gettysburg. And that's kind of really interesting. Nothing, and all
it
of a sudden
is.
You have you have this proliferation. In the 60s, you have all these reenactments going on. You have a centennial of Gettysburg. You have all these other things going on. You have the internet becoming important. So everything is self-perpetuating. One person comes out and claims, "Well, I saw this or I heard this. Well, we're on a battlefield. This must be, you know, I haven't heard that sound before." So it must be the sound of the battle. So people identify, well, I heard this. And if you go out into the battlefield, people say when they see visual manifestations, what they see on the battlefield, they say, well, I saw these soldiers in formation marching up and down in formation drilling. Or I saw one or two soldiers walking around we're on a battlefield here. How could you see soldiers drilling on a battlefield? You just don't.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and another thing is in book four, I identify. Okay, I'll tell you. Okay, let's look at it. Let's just say that maybe Gettysburg is haunted. So how do we go about determining if it is or is it not haunted? Well, what I do is I do a positional survey. Okay, that is, I pick a specific cultural tendency, or in this case, it's a battlefield. It's a military tactic that was used during the Civil War. And what this is COCOA, K-O-C-O-A. The COCOA is still used at West Point today in military strategy. It's terrain analysis. COCOA, I'll explain what it is in a minute, but COCOA was used by Meade and Lee at Gettysburg. COCOA stands for, K is for key area, O is for observation area, C is for cover and concealment area, O is for obstacle area, and A is for avenue of approach. So if we want to look at hauntings, if we're in a key area, we would expect, for example, to find interactive entities if they are, because the key area is where there were major military engagements, hence, i.e., there were people who were killed in that area. Mm-hmm. Therefore, you might have a tendency to have interactive entities in that area. Now, in a cover and concealment area is where they were under, one, they were undercover, so there wouldn't be any death there, and two, they were maybe in a holding area where they were behind the lines waiting to go into battle, or this was an encampment behind the lines. So again, you would have no interactive entities there, but you would have residual elements there because, for example, you would be able to maybe do some EVP, pick up some conversations. You would also maybe get some olfactory manifestations, the smell of coffee, the smell of tobacco, but you wouldn't have any interactive presences. You see what I mean?
Mm-hmm. So that's residual.
Yeah, that would be residual. So you would mm-hmm. have residual elements in certain areas. You would have the possibility of interactive elements in other areas, and they would not cross one another. So if you're just going out onto the battlefield and walking around and taking pictures, taking photos or taking video, whatever, and you come upon a light anomaly or you hear somebody in the bush or something like that, well, that's probably possibly another ghost hunter. You know, mm-hmm. trying to do some kind of a ghost to come out and manifest. So maybe you're picking up another ghost hunter or something like that because out on that battlefield at night, there's a lot of people walking around doing a lot of different things.
Sure.
You know, there's no control there. So what I approach it is I do it during the day. I don't do it at night. So I do it during the day. I choose various areas, and I'm still working on this. I'm trying to map out the battlefield using this COCOA positional approach. I map it out saying, well, this will be the possibility of having residual energies in this particular cover and concealment area. There's a possibility in this key area to have interactive presences. Then I would go out and see if I get anything using what I call peripatetic video. Peripatetic video is walking around, use a video camera, and you use binaural headphones, and you try to pick up the sounds as you're walking around. So you're picking up the audio and the video at the same time as you're walking around. Then what I do, if I detect any kind of anomaly, and I'll just say an anomaly in a general sense.
Sure.
I would come back to that area, and if it's a residual energy, I can't really control it manifesting. But if there's a possibility of something going on, like an interactive presence in the key area, what I would go back, and that's what I would do, an excavating. And an excavating for me is what I call, I use method acting, I use theatrical ghosting, I use morphic resonance.
All right. Before you get into ghost excavating, let's go back just a couple of things here I wanted to bring out. Okay, so just to recap what we've talked about so far, the hauntings at Gettysburg, you believe, are largely residual, or
yep.
can be perhaps.
Yep.
So what you're doing, if I'm hearing you right, you're kind of bucking the flow on a lot of Gettysburg researchers, where you're saying that for the first 100 years there was really no activity, and then all of a sudden, as a result of, shall we say, cultural influence,
exactly.
That is tours,
heritage tourism.
Okay,
concept,
good enough.
The concept of heritage tourism had a lot to do with it, because heritage tourism is focused on individuality, person getting into focusing on getting a authentic experience. And what better way to get an authentic experience on the battlefield is to feel the sounds of the Civil War still there.
Sure. So people are going on tours starting in the 60s. Awareness is being raised. There are a lot of people there. They're hearing funky things they can't explain, so all of a sudden it's a ghost.
Right.
Okay, interesting.
I mean,
all right.
It's more detailed than that, and I mean, the book is 250 pages, and it's very, very detailed about. I divide it into about 15 different ideas that should be investigated that haven't been investigated yet. So what I'm saying is, Gettysburg may or may not be haunted, but right now, based on the evidence, I cannot say that it is.
Okay.
Now, I'm not only bucking ghost research, but I'm also bucking the tourism industry, because the tourism industry for ghosts is very, very popular. So if you go to a lot of websites, a lot of these websites that promote Gettysburg as being very haunted is also related to tourism.
Mm-hmm.
It's a multi-million-dollar business. And so a lot of people don't like what I say when I go
sure.
to Gettysburg. So, but
well, I can
I
imagine.
See it like I see it, you know.
Right.
I mean, if we, you know, I'm not trying to say there aren't any. I'm just trying to say if we want to say that there are, let's do it using a very, very specific approach. And
right.
It's the positional survey to begin with, and one basic idea of the positional survey is this Kokoa approach, which is very logical to me, a key area versus a cover and concealment area. Boom, you have one thing here and you have another thing there, and you can't have soldiers drilling on a battlefield during a major engagement, because it's not logical.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, what they're seeing,
it makes sense.
And what you see on the battlefield, why don't you smell all of that guts and gore that was there at Gettysburg? Why don't you see people blown to bits out there on the battlefield? Why don't you see people being beheaded with a shot from a 51 caliber bullet? You know, you don't see any of that stuff.
Interesting.
Why? Not even residual. You don't even see. So why? All you see is the plastic, passive interactions. Person walking around.
Well, you see culturally acceptable images.
Exactly. Culturally, 21st century culturally acceptable. But what happened at Gettysburg is not 21st century culturally acceptable, because what happened at Gettysburg is horrible. Was horrible.
Right.
I mean, the things, you know, people just blown to bits all over the place. You don't see that as residual energy at Gettysburg. I never saw anybody, ghost hunter, tell me this is what they saw, or this is what they smelt, or this is what they felt, you know.
Okay, so let me see. All right. Oh, I had a question. All right, so you're approaching this as a cultural anthropologist, meaning that you've had training from a scientific approach, which is what you're taking, correct?
Right.
You're basically saying, okay, if there is activity, let's document it, but let's substantiate it in a scientific and rationally meaningful way.
What? But beyond that, what I'm saying is we cannot, as investigators, we cannot be passive. We cannot just go there, set up our equipment and monitor from a distance, monitor the frame of haunted space from a distance, and spend all night waiting for something to happen. I don't wait for something to happen. I try to make something happen by my performances. So
all right.
I make 8 hours of work. I make 1 hour do 8 hours of work.
Is that the ghost excavating then?
Yeah, that's the ghost.
Okay,
excavating.
So describe that process then.
Well, what I try to do is what I call ghost excavating is I try to do a performative unearthing of agency, and that's what the agency is. What is the entity itself? Okay, I believe that what's occurring is not paranormal, supernatural. It's human agency. So that's why I approach it from a cultural anthropologist perspective.
Okay, human agency on the part of humans or spirits?
Well, first of all, I make a distinction between a ghost and a spirit. Okay, a spirit is an entity that has crossed over and come back. A ghost has not crossed over yet.
All right, fair enough. So human agency's ghost or human?
Well, the agency is a ghost that still retains its cultural values and personality when it was physically alive.
Okay.
So what I'm saying is, if you were a boring human being, after physical death, you're a boring ghost.
Yeah. Well, that follows with a lot of things. I mean, if you're a nice person in life, you're likely to be a nice person in death. If you're an asshole in life, you're an asshole in death.
Now I believe that this doing this unearthing, this excavating, what it is actually, it's a rehearsal, an investigative rehearsal. I try different cultural inducements and see what kind of responses I get. I see what works and what doesn't work. So maybe I might try 10 different things, target objects, target activities, see what works, what doesn't work. But what I am doing is I did the preliminary peripatetic walk, video walk around a particular area. For example, a key area at Gettysburg. I do a peripatetic video walk. In the performance, all of my equipment is out of frame, okay? It's not in the frame. What I mean by that is it's not the center of what I call a SIMS. SIMS is the sensory information memory system. It's the zone where anomalies are occurring. I am at the center of that SIMS zone.
Sure.
My equipment is out in the periphery. So what I am doing is I have a video camera. I have a person playing back that positional survey, that initial peripatetic video. It's playing it back. At the same time, the camera is recording that playback, but the camera is also recording my performances in that frame.
Mm-hmm.
So it's recording, so it's giving you a comparison right there. Before, before non-performance, and during a performance. So you're getting the comparison. Nothing happening here. Something is happening here. So it's recording both things, the playback and the live performance.
So describe the performance.
So, you know, I do things. First of all, I study the culture of the haunting. Okay, haunting could be a residual, because also for a residual haunting, I want to know what's going on and to understand. I'm not trying to explain the residual haunting. I'm trying to understand it, and to understand it, you have to understand it from a cultural perspective. So I have to have knowledge of the culture of the residual or the culture of the interactive entity. So I have to do a lot of background work on, okay, what is going on here? Civil War site. If it's a Victorian house, it's a Victorian house. I have to understand the period. Okay, who lives in the house? What was their personality? What was their culture? What was the culture at the time? So I have to do a lot of research, background research, to get in there, and then I use various target objects, target activities. Sound for me is extremely, extremely important, because sound has a resonating effect. It recalls memory.
Meaning so, recording, I mean, or playing, or both?
Playing it. Playing
so it. What kind of sounds do you play then?
Well, it depends. For example, I did an investigation of the Farnsworth House and the Holman House in Gettysburg. There is an entity called Little Jeremy, who is a 4 to 6-year-old boy who was supposedly killed by a wagon and horses. He was trampled by horses. He was taken upstairs to the Sarah Black room in the Farnsworth house, and he lingered for a day or two, and then he died. Well, Little Jeremy is supposedly haunting this Farnsworth house, the house across the street, the Holman house, and another house across the street. Now so I figured, okay, so if this is a 4 to 6-year-old boy haunting, okay, what? And this is the period of history is probably the 1850s to the 1880s. So I did a lot of research to say, okay, what kind of activities would a little boy be interested in that period of time, in that historical period? What kind of music would he be listening to? What kind of games would he be playing? What kind of food would he be eating? Okay. So what I do is I devise a ghost script, and I enact out a ghost script. So, for example, with little Jeremy, the story is that little Jeremy was younger than the rest of the boys. The boys were like 4 or 5 years older than him, so he wanted to prove himself. So what happens was Gettysburg was a carriage industry. It was noted for making carriages prior to the Civil War and a little bit after the Civil War, then it dwindled out. But it was noted for making carriages. So down Baltimore Street, which is one of the main thoroughfares of Gettysburg, you'd have all these horses and carriages coming down the street. So the story goes that little Jeremy and his friends would run out and try to tag the horses as they came down Baltimore Street and then run back to the side of the building and see who would run the fastest and tag the horses and run back, and then they would be the winner.
Mm-hmm.
Well, Jeremy wanted to prove himself, and so there was multiple horse carriage coming down the street. He ran out, touched one of the horses, turned around, tripped, and was trampled. His father, who I don't know his actual last name or his first name, the mother is never mentioned, his father arrived, took him up to the Sour Black Room, which is now in the Farnsworth Bed and Breakfast. There was a bedroom in there, which is now the bathroom in the Sour Black Room. Jeremy was there for a day or two. He lingered, and his father was in the other room, pacing back and forth, you know, just waiting for something, you know, how's he going to do? And then, well, Jeremy expired, and he died there. Now, it is interesting. Before I knew the history, I was in the Sour Black Room with my daughter one night, maybe about 10, 15 years ago, and we were in the Sour Black Room, and I couldn't sleep at all night. All I heard was somebody walking up and down. And I didn't know nothing about the history.
Okay, so now how do you explain the sounds you heard of somebody walking up and down?
Well,
how do you compare that or factor that in with the cultural influences?
This is very easy. What happened was later on, they gave me I had full access. This is like years later. I had full access to the Farnsworth house. I was the only one in the house along with my daughter, and I did an all night investigation in the Farnsworth house. We were the only ones in the house. I was up in the third floor, and I was hearing sounds from downstairs. This was like maybe when downstairs they had the dining room and they had the kitchen. Well, I was up on the third floor, and I was hearing footsteps all the way downstairs.
Mm-hmm.
So the house is very, very compressed, that the sounds really echo up from very, very far away. So what I was hearing maybe up there was maybe somebody downstairs walking around. But what happened was, this is very, very interesting. So I said, okay, if Jeremy died 46 years old, what kind of activities? I did this performance in the Holman house, and I did the same thing in the Farnsworth house. I did not get any response in the Farnsworth house, but I did get a response in the Holman house. And what happened was in the Holman house, what I said was, okay, I had a psychic there, and she said that she senses the presence of Jeremy every so often. So that the night we were doing the investigation, I asked her to do an initial psychic sweep to see if supposedly Jeremy was there. You know,
mm-hmm.
I'll give it to her that she knows that there's an entity there. So she said, I'll give you that, okay?
Right.
So she says, oh yeah, I think Jeremy is around. So I said, okay, well let's try some investigative rehearsals, and see what transpires. So I had preset cameras in the hallway where supposedly Jeremy was, and in where I was, which was in the next room. And then I set up motion detectors in the doorway between where I was and in the hallway. So what I said was, I said, okay, I played some music that I recorded that was original music from the 1850s and 1840s, just a sort of like an ambient atmosphere.
Familiarity.
Right, and then I started saying, "Well, Jeremy, let's have a family hour. We're going to sit down here, and we're going to play some games. What we're going to do is we're going to play a game of tag." So what I did was I got the story of Black Beauty, but I got illustrations. Black Beauty was written in the 1850s.
Mm-hmm.
I got illustrations from a book that was published in the 1850s of a horses and carriage.
Mm-hmm.
I cut the illustrations out from this 1850s book. I put the illustrations in the hallway where supposedly Jeremy is, and I also put it in some other different places.
Mm-hmm.
So what I tried to do is recreate his death, but without the trauma. So what I said to Jeremy, we're going to play a game of tag. And what I used is colloquial expressions from the 1850s language. I used some vocabulary words that one children used, and that were identifiable in the 1850s, so I interspersed them into what I was talking
mm-hmm.
about, so he would understand those words that were familiar to him. I also did an investigation on who lived in the house at that time. So I was naming names of mm-hmm. children who lived in that house. So I said, Jeremy, we're going to talk about Jimmy Smith and Joey Brown.
Mm-hmm.
That was, those weren't the names. So we're all going to come together. We're going to play this game, see who can get to the horse first and tag the horse, and then come back to me, and they'll be the winner. And then I'll have some things for you, some treats for you, okay?
Mm-hmm.
So this camera was rolling in the hallway all the time, you know, and there was nothing being picked up, okay? Where I was, there was nothing being picked up. So I said, okay, Jeremy, at the count of three, you're going to go and run over to where the horse is as fast as you can and then come back to me. So in that, I didn't see this till after we replayed it back, but in that video in the hallway, there was nothing there for, you know, for half an hour while I was doing my, you know,
mm-hmm.
my preliminary stuff. And you could hear me talking in the background saying, at the count of three, Jeremy, you're going to go over and touch this photograph, this drawing of a horse. So you can hear me say, one, two, and before I got to three, all of a sudden, boom, this light anomaly appears in the hallway.
Really?
Then starts to move over to the stairway and stops right in front of where this horse drawing was. It stays there, stationary for about 5 or 6 seconds, and then disappears.
Wow.
I can't explain it. So I thought, okay, that's interesting.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I don't know what's going on, so let's do something else. So 2 weeks later, I had an investigator with an EMF meter and a flashlight in that hallway. I had two motion detectors in that doorway, and I was in this other room with the psychic saying, yeah, I think Jeremy's around. So I got these marbles, but I got these reproductions of marbles from the 1860s.
Uh-huh.
I said, Jeremy, we're going to play a little game of marbles. So I started playing with these marbles. The psychic says, I think I sense Jeremy in the other room by the stairway. All of a sudden, boop, 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 boop.
Really? Motion detector.
The EMF starts. And then all of a sudden, the investigator says, uh-oh, my battery's just drained. I have no light. 2 or 3 seconds later, boop, 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 boop. The motion detector goes off.
Cool.
And then we come into where I'm playing with the marbles, and the psychic says, he's here. He's watching you play marbles. Boop, 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 boop. Her handheld EMF starts to spike. So I says, okay, take some photos, 35mm digital,
mm-hmm.
of me playing with the marbles.
Mm-hmm.
Afterwards, when we looked at the photos, in both digital and 35mm, there was orbs between my fingers and the marbles.
Hmm.
Can't explain it. I'm still not convinced it's something. So, but you have that sequence, perfect sequence. You have the EMF
right off
in that room where supposedly he was. You have the draining of the batteries. You have the motion detector, the EMF, the psychic saying something, and then the photograph. So that's
okay.
It's kind of...
As a scientist now, in your scientific mind, how do you explain that sequence of events? What's your conclusion?
What I'm getting is that I'm using a specific cultural script that may be working.
Mm-hmm.
Two, I use the cultural script twice, and it's reiterative. It repeated itself. So that's very, very important scientifically.
Mm-hmm.
I use two different methods, but using the same cultural type of script on two different dates, and I got two different types of manifestations, but they're all related to the Jeremy phenomenon.
Okay, so let me ask you this. All right, so you've got this activity. You're wanting to play marbles. The psychic sensing Jeremy in the area. The EMF meter in the hallway goes off, then the motion detector goes off, and then she senses Jeremy in the room with you, and the EMF meter goes off. So as a scientist, now, this is my question, and this is not a loaded question at all. I'm just curious. As a scientist, how would you conclude? I mean, is that proof positive? Or?
No. I'm not trying to explain. My first level is not to try to explain what happened.
Scientifically or anyway?
No. I'm not trying to explain what happened. I first have to understand what happened. And my understanding of what happened is that I used a particular cultural script. I performed it twice, and it worked twice.
Okay.
So now that means my understanding is my investigative practice possibly works by using a cultural performed script, and it's reiterative. It repeated itself. Now, in order to prove it again, I got to do it a couple more times, and it has to work again and again.
Okay, so
then I might have to say, well, I think we got something. Then I have to look at all my other options. Can I explain it away by using a null hypothesis? What other possibilities are to explain everything that happened in sequence? So the first thing is, it's an understanding, not an interpretation of what happened. The understanding of what happened is that I'm using particular practices. The practices are creating some form of anomalous manifestation. So therefore, my practices may be working. But let's pursue this further. So I'm not at that level of interpretation
okay.
yet.
Gotcha.
I'm at a level of possibly understanding a phenomenon that it's occurring, but I'm not interpreting it yet.
Okay, I got you. Yep, it does. Because that's what I was wanting to know. I mean, you get some of these events that happen like that, and you're trying to use a scientific process. You're looking at what you've got. You can't explain it with natural occurrences. It would seem to fit the scenario that there was actually an entity there by the name of Jeremy or somebody who was doing exactly what you were asking them to do.
Now, what was interesting is I performed the same thing across the street where he died.
And?
At Farnsworth House. Now, nothing happened. Now, there is one variable that I didn't tell you. There is a difference between the first, the Holman House where things happened, and the Farnsworth House where things didn't happen. And the one variable that I changed was the time. In the Holman House, I did it at 7 p.m. In the Farnsworth House, I did it at 11 p.m. Now, if we believe or we understand that possibly this is a child, at 7 o'clock, p.m. he would be awake, but at 11 o'clock at night he would be sleeping.
Yeah, interesting. Okay, so there's, yeah, that is an interesting observation. All right, we've got a question. Have you ever proven anything is there, and if so, what do you do with it then?
No, I haven't proven anything to my satisfaction. I am very, very strict about, and I don't really want to prove anything because that sort of takes away the enthusiasm I have of doing these things. I like the level of understanding things, that what I'm doing may be inducing some type of manifestation. So I am at that level. I'm satisfied with that level of understanding, but I want to go out and use all kinds of different variables and try to reiterate those same kind of manifestations. So the idea of interpreting this as ghostly phenomenon or haunting phenomenon, I'm not even thinking about that yet.
Well, what's your ultimate objective? I mean, why are you doing this?
I'm trying to develop a database
mm-hmm.
for the understanding of what is occurring. So I have a database of a child from the mid 19th century. Okay, that database and that practice may be working. So I want to do a comparison with another cultural horizon at a different location and a different type of manifestation. I'm not trying to develop law-like generalizations about haunting phenomena, but I'm trying to see, you know, could we go cross-culturally? Could these performative practices be practiced cross-culturally and through different time periods? And if they do, this is the important point, if they do, then space is definitely symmetrical and time is definitely unfolding.
Okay, so
that's what I'm trying to get at.
So by understanding this stuff, and let's just assume for a moment that these performances are producing results consistently. Again, to what end, in your opinion?
To prove that the past is not dead, for one, that the past still continues to percolate in the present, that physical death does not mean complete death, that one way to legitimize ghost research is to use it as a transdisciplinary approach for people to say, ghost researchers or ghost investigators, ghost hunters, that's a bunch of bull. Or, why do it? It doesn't have no legitimacy. So what I'm trying to do is by developing understandable cultural, investigative, performative practices, I am bringing legitimacy to ghost excavation and ghost research. I hate the word ghost hunting.
Yeah, me too.
A lot of people go out there and they don't know what they're doing. They just go out and take photos. I've seen this all the time, taking photos, and all of a sudden they come up with, oh, look what I got. I got an anomaly here, a light anomaly. That's normal. Oh, there has to be a ghost. Well, that's the same thing as an archaeologist who goes into a plowed field, and walking through the plowed field, he picks up an arrowhead. It has no cultural context, so it's completely irrelevant, and it has no meaning at all. What I'm trying to do is bring relevancy
from a scientific point of view.
Right, to make it, one, legitimate, and also to make it very contextual. I mean, I got a specific context where I got a specific manifestation using a specific cultural practice. That makes it a lot more legitimate than just going out there in the field and wandering around. Some people, a lot of times, especially at Gettysburg, you have drunks all the time out there in the field, which really burns me up. They're just out there drunk and having a good old time, which really makes me mad, for one thing. And that's why the park is no longer open till 10 p.m., people tramping around out there not knowing what they're doing. So what I'm trying to do, if you're asking me what my goal is to bring legitimacy to what we're doing, because
scientific legitimacy.
Well, yeah, I don't like to use the word scientific legitimacy. I'm trying to make it a transdisciplinary approach that uses, this is what's going on. I mean, in archaeology and anthropology, this whole transdisciplinary approach is what's going on in the 21st century in archaeology. So I'm trying to bring ghost research into the field of social science, into the field of the humanities, and not make it something out there in the periphery, out there in the fringe, this is paranormal. I don't use the word paranormal very often. I can use the word paracultural. That's what's going on. You've got cultural activities, manifestations that are going on. They're not paranormal at all. If you understand what's really going on, if you really look down at, for example, in the 19th century, sound was very, came back, just give you an example. I don't know if I can mention it. I just came back from shooting a segment of Paranormal State.
Okay.
And they called me down because I was one of the experts on the Civil War. It was a Civil War site in Petersburg.
Mm-hmm.
And they didn't tell me what was going on. They said it's a Confederate soldier at this house, and that's all they told me.
Uh-huh.
So I did research and said, okay, Civil War soldier, blah blah blah. Let me see here. Now, sound was very, very important to 19th century culture, and between the North and the South, sound was very, very distinct. In the South, you had a very tranquil, quiet culture, mode of life. Everything was, the plantation, everything was rhythmical, quiet. But in the North, you had a lot of industrialization. So the sound level in the North was a lot louder than the sound level in the South. The Northern soldier was more accustomed to noise than the Southern soldier. So in a battle, the Southern soldier would be a lot more sensitive than all these cannon fires and rifle fires and everything going on. Now, where this haunting was occurring was at Petersburg, which had an 8-month siege going on there. So you had constant bombardment, i.e. a lot of sound. This house was located where the, after 8 months, where the Union soldiers penetrated and finally got into to Petersburg. So if there was a Confederate soldier there, I would say that he was either a deserter or he was afraid of something and he was in hiding. What was occurring in that house was they were renovating the house.
Mm-hmm.
So what I said on camera was, well, wait a minute. The haunting is occurring because the Confederate soldier sound is very, very important. The haunting is occurring not because of the renovations itself, but because of the sounds
of
the
renovation.
Mm. So, and I said this on camera, and Ryan said that, well, that's interesting because the son who is seeing the ghost is, every time he plays his drum, he sees the ghost.
Hmm.
The sounds of the drums.
Mm-hmm.
And then I go upstairs and I go into this and I just felt something in this one room. I said, this is the room. This is the room where this Confederate soldier comes through. This is where he's in hiding. And Ryan says, well, this is the bedroom of the 18-year-old kid and this is where he first saw the ghost.
Hmm. Interesting.
So, yeah. So I like to see, okay, what happens on camera. I don't know what else happened in the house.
Well,
What I'm trying to do is, you know, so I'm, again, the whole anthropological approach,
mm-hmm,
to it, you know, the culture, the importance of sound, South versus the North, Civil War. So, you know, the cultural practices are very, very important, you know, especially the sound.
Very interesting. Very, very interesting. All right. We're coming up at the top of the hour, and we appreciate your questions. There's still a question or two to be asked from the chat room. We'll take those after the break. I just wanted to mention, too, for our listeners that I've got electrical storms going on here, too. So for some odd reason we get dropped, I'll try to reconnect, so hang with us. And we're talking with John Sable, cultural anthropologist, ghost excavator. Very interesting conversation we're having. If you'll hang with us, we'll be back in just a few minutes, and we'll continue this conversation. Hang with us. This is Doug Kelly, founder of the Spirit Team. We perform professional paranormal research and investigations at no charge to you. If you are experiencing mysterious events in your home or business, please contact us. We maintain your privacy and we won't think you're crazy. And if you're a paranormal researcher, we offer an accredited certification course that will enhance your knowledge of the paranormal field and raise credibility with your clients. For more information, please visit our website at spiritteam.org. That's spiritteam with one T, .org.
Is there a suppression of UFO and alien information by our government?
Does the soul continue on after we die?
Climb aboard the black ship of Paranormal Radio with your host, Captain Jack, on Contact Talk Radio and KRWM 106.9 FM HD3. Or visit WPRTRadio.com for more information.
Where will you find a professional association of paranormal researchers?
Paranexus.org.
Where can you get research training, share data, and network with other researchers?
Paranexus.org.
Where will you find a set of international standards for paranormal research groups?
Paranexus.org.
Paranexus is a global professional association of progressive paranormal investigators, parapsychologists, cryptozoologists, ufologists, and psychically gifted individuals focused on understanding the human condition through the scientific study of paranormal and psychical phenomena. And coming October 2008 to Tampa, Florida, the Paranexus Conference, a learning and networking event unlike any you've attended. Join us for 2 full days of innovative paranormal workshops. Participate in the Paranexus Challenge, where several teams will investigate a secret haunted location. Observe a live table-tipping seance at the stroke of midnight. Join us for the Spirits and Shadows Costume Ball. See old friends, meet new friends, win prizes, and have fun.
Paranexus.org.
A place to learn, a place to share, a place to network, a place to come together. Join us now at Paranexus.org.
And welcome back, everybody. This is Doug Kelly, Paranexus Universe. Grant is on vacation this week, so he's not with us, and hope he's having a good time. We are talking with our guest, John Sable, cultural anthropologist and actor, ghost excavator. Welcome back, John.
Hi, how you doing?
Hey, and again, happy birthday. Try to say it a couple of times, that way you feel very special.
Yes, it's nice to be 25.
Yeah.
I thought I'd remain 20 for a long time, but
Hey, 25 is good, man.
Getting old.
Yeah, I know it. If our listeners out there would like to call in, we'd love to take your calls. The number there is on your screen, 347-945-7799. You can also ask questions in the chat room if you wish. We do have a question or two. Let's take one question. Let's see. I'm looking at, there's several questions regarding your experience with Jeremy.
Uh-huh.
One of the questions, if you could prove that Jeremy is there, would you try to find a remedy to a situation?
I didn't really finish my story about Jeremy.
Go ahead.
Okay, when I was doing this, the first one in the Holman house and where he manifested and, well, supposedly manifested in this light anomaly that stopped at this horse and then faded away and it disappeared. What I did right after that, before I reviewed the video, because I didn't see the video until about an hour later, but the next activity that I did was I called Jeremy into the room where I was, and I said, okay, we're going to have a little snack before you go to bed. And so I got some food that was typical of the mid-19th century. I forgot what I got out for him. But I just simulated that we were going to eat, and he was going to eat something, but that it was getting late, and that he would have to go upstairs to the light where his mom and dad are waiting for him. So what I tried to do was get him to go to the light, because I believe that if he's an actual entity, that one of my goals as a ghost excavator is to cross him over. Because
mm-hmm.
if I didn't do that, I feel like I would be enslaving him,
mm-hmm.
and I'd be exploiting him. Oh, I'm going to exploit this guy so I can make some money off of it. And that's not what my goal is. So in all of my performances, I always try to do something, but within context, to get them to go to the light. And in Jeremy's case, I tried him to go upstairs to the light where his parents were waiting for him to put him to sleep. And that was my inducement to get him to go to the light.
You know, that's a great point, and I really appreciate that from you, because so many groups out there And I'm with you, by the way. I hate the word, the term ghost hunting. We don't hunt ghosts any more than we would hunt people. We do paranormal research. If you don't like the word paranormal, that's fine. A lot of researchers don't. Anomalous research, whatever you want to call it. The thing, though, that a lot of them do, they're in it for the thrill of the hunt, so to speak. They don't know what they're doing. They're weekend warriors. You know, that's one thing. But if you're going to do this seriously, do it seriously and make a contribution to the grand scheme of things. Because as I keep blurting out but not finishing, a lot of groups out there, they are watchers. They're observers. They don't really try to get involved and to understand, as you've been talking about, what's going on and what can we do to help. You know, because if these ghosts are stuck, which the theory suggests that they are stuck for a variety of reasons, unfinished business, don't know they're dead, have, in my opinion, one of the causes for sticking around being earthbound is serious psychological issues or emotional issues that they haven't resolved. There's a variety of reasons just that can keep them. But one of the things that we do, and then I encourage groups out there listening, what can you do to help? I mean, the idea behind a research, an investigation, is to not only understand what's going on, but if a client is, in fact, observing or has paranormal activity going on, you got to seek to resolve that, whatever that means. And as I've said so many times on this program, that the majority of the things that we have investigated involve psychology on the part of the client. They don't really involve real paranormal events. So you've got to resolve that. Seek to understand what's going on. And if there is a spirit there, like Jeremy in this case, seek to help them resolve that. Send them on, you know, help them to feel comfortable about moving on. And John, what you said about, you know, making it inviting, go upstairs to the light where your parents are waiting, you know, that's a lot different than saying, you know, you need to cross over, find that light, and go into it. It makes it, you're talking on the level of a five-year-old.
Yeah, I'm also talking on his cultural level, too. You know, that's why I always have to put it within cultural. It's context. It's cultural context. So I try to do that, and that gives me a lot of satisfaction. That gives me a lot of thrill. I mean, having to do these practices, these cultural practices that I do, and to see something react to those practices, mm-hmm. man, that's a big thrill for me. You know.
Yeah.
But really, what irks me, what I see, I hate to say, use Gettysburg as a stepping stone. But I mean, what I see at Gettysburg is the manipulation of the hauntings there. Mm-hmm. I mean, if there are, you know, soldiers there that are dead and that haven't crossed over, my God, cross them over. But cross them over, you know, not by saying you got to cross over. I mean, use the cultural context that they
metaphor, if you will.
Getting back to Gettysburg, though, that 100-year period, you know, mm-hmm. during that whole period of the 1850s, the 1860s, spiritualism was very, very popular and important in the Northeast. Mm-hmm. Now, after the battle, for months and months and months, there were families searching for their lost relatives and their lost loved ones, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the major inducements of spiritualism at that time was to try to talk to the dead.
Right.
So I would think that type of activity, especially what happened at Gettysburg, would really be a haven for that type of spiritualistic movement, and we have absolutely nothing. There's no idea of any spiritualist activity at Gettysburg after the battle and years later. No, nothing at all. We don't have any ghost photography, and that was very, very important, too, in the spiritualist movement. We don't have any of that at Gettysburg. And we have a lot of photographs of the battlefield and a lot of photographs of dead soldiers. But we don't have any orbs in those photos. We don't have anything. That's another thing. Why? You know, and...
Well, how do you...
Yeah,
go ahead. You go ahead. Well, how do you explain it? No orbs, nothing.
Right.
And that goes back to your cultural anthropology answer.
But see, the whole idea, spiritualism from a cultural perspective was very, very popular in New York, Pennsylvania, et cetera, et cetera. But it should have really blossomed in Gettysburg because it had the right reason. For all those people that were lost or that were not found, relatives should have went out there and asked spiritualists and mediums to help them find their dead relatives.
Why didn't
or
they?
Contact their dead. Why didn't they? Exactly. Why didn't they? Because there was no need to. In the culture of that time, there was a belief in spirits and ghosts, but at Gettysburg, why wasn't there? If Gettysburg was so haunted, acre for acre, the most haunted battlefield in the nation, why didn't the spiritualists go there? They would be making a lot of money, you would think, right?
Mm-hmm.
Just from an economic standpoint, there's absolutely nothing.
Well, it's interesting that even some charlatans didn't go there.
No.
Or
no,
did they?
Absolutely. No. Well, they had people that would take them out to see the relics, that, you know, like, you know, the cadavers, you know, the bones and stuff like that. Or this is the place where a big battle takes place. So people were interested in the macabre and the morbid aspects of the battle, but none of that related to ghosts and hauntings. It was physical remains only, not physical remains after death. Physical, visible remains, the skeletons, relics from the battle, rifles, canteens, whatever, the morbid aspects, the witness trees where all the bullets were going through that survived the battle. The guides would take them out to all these morbid curiosities, but nothing related to
Well, here's a question. All right, let's assume for a moment that the theories are correct. We're speculating that, you know, people die. I mean, they die everywhere, not just Gettysburg, but anywhere
exactly.
And everywhere. Okay, so they die. Many of them do. All right, folks, apologize for that. Like I said earlier, we have thunderstorms in the area, and my internet connection dropped out on me. So apologize for that. I think we've got John back. You back, John?
Yeah, I'm here.
All right, sorry about that. The electrical storms, I imagine, are messing up the system. But let's see if we can get back into the conversation. Okay, people die a lot of places, right? And many of them remain earthbound for one reason or another. What about Gettysburg? With all the people that died there, all the soldiers, wouldn't you expect some of them?
Okay, let me give you an example. I don't want to plug another book, but this is...
No, plug your books. That's what it's here for. Okay.
This is in my new book called The Politics of Presence. In my new book, I talk about the Battle of Verdun. Do you know anything about the Battle of Verdun?
No, not personally, no, but go ahead.
It was a battle that lasted like almost a year, continuous engagement. More than 1 million soldiers died at Verdun. They have an ostuary where they have 250,000 remains of unknown soldiers.
Oh, man.
So you had 1 million soldiers dying in that physical space. You had 250,000 unknown. Guess what? No ghosts.
Why?
You tell me.
Well,
you see, so if people say, this is the argument about Gettysburg. Oh, yeah, so many people died young. They didn't know they were going to die. That's BS, because they did know that they were going to die. I mean, battle tactics, Napoleonic battle tactics that were used during the Civil War, you knew you were going to die. You marching into that field, you knew you were going to die. So that's not the... I explained.
Right.
And another thing, they died young. Well, look at Verdun. All of those 1 million or more died, but we have one instance of a sighting of a ghost that was on a British TV show in the 1990s that mentioned a possible paranormal activity in some of the tunnels at Verdun. One incident with 1 million deaths at Verdun. So that pales, Gettysburg pales to comparison.
All right, so now let's continue that line of reasoning. If that's the case, then why other places? Why other places?
I think the cultural factor has to be involved in it. What was the cultural belief at the time? Now there's a lot of books. Now this is interesting because there's a lot of books coming out about the idea of suffering and death during the Civil War. And if you read some of these books, they talk about how the idea of death was changed in mid-19th century America by the Civil War. What's interesting, one point was made, is so many of these soldiers died away from family and friends and in unknown places, and they lost that ritual of transference from dying to death, because those deaths, especially in the South, usually occurred with family present, and they had this whole ritual process of dying. But these young soldiers who went out on the battlefields during the Civil War, especially Southern soldiers, they were denied this ritual, familiar ritual of the dying process out there in the fields. Yet, why don't we have so many manifestations of ghosts?
Could it be that they traveled back home?
Well, see, that's another thing. What I'm trying to do, I'm trying to see if I can get, I'm trying to do some ethnographic research to try to figure out if there's any crisis apparitional sightings at home, for example, after major battles.
Uh-huh.
That would be logical. You know, if you have a crisis apparition occurring to the family at home, you die in a battlefield thousands, hundreds of miles away, and you appear to your family either at the moment of death or right after death. I'm trying to go in the ethnographic literature to see if there's any instances of that happening. That would be an interesting study.
Well, you would think there'd be a ton of them if it was
but there isn't.
A real phenomenon.
What I've studied so far, there isn't. So now people might argue, well, it takes a long time for a ghost to manifest.
Mm.
I don't think so.
No.
Who said that? Who made that up?
Yeah,
you know,
that's just conjecture.
Who made up that an orb is a spirit? And some people even say an orb is the soul. Now, who made that up? You know, I know who made it up.
Oh, yeah?
I mean, you know, that's not true. How is that verified? So I don't like, I've read one book where one individual in this one book coined all of these phrases, and I mentioned it in my latest book. This individual, but I will not name that individual, but this person coined all of these phrases that are occurring in ghost research. Wow, isn't that interesting? But some of these phrases have been around for, I mean, we have an archaeologist from Britain who's the first one who talked about residual energies and ghosts and residual energies. T.H. Lethbridge. He's a British archaeologist. He has a book, Ghost and Ghoul, from 1962, and it's all about his an archaeologist having paranormal experiences, and he talks about his paranormal experiences as an archaeologist. So I'm not the first archaeologist who talks about paranormal experiences. But T.C. Lethbridge, he's the one to mention the importance of water, for example, and residual energy. He's the first one to bring that up, and this was like in the 1950s. So this individual, he says, I coined, or the orb term, I coined this, I coined that, I coined this. Come on, give me a break.
Yeah, I know who you're talking about. And, you know, obviously there's not, I mean, anybody who, I'm sorry, this is my personal opinion, but anybody who fancies themselves as professional researchers and still calls himself a ghost hunter hasn't gotten it yet. They haven't taken it to the next level. And the thing I really want to focus on here, again, is the implications for what you're talking about. And I find this very interesting because, like you, I am extremely interested in the cultural anthropological aspect, the psychological aspect, including fantasy-prone people, including mass hysteria and other mass illusionary aspects. You know, the cultural conditioning, the belief system of why we have so many. Now, I'm not saying that things are not occurring, because things are occurring. I just don't know what the source is, and I don't know that anybody does, but that's what we're trying to figure out. What's the source? But if you're saying that all these people died in these certain locations, and yet we don't have many, if any, crisis apparitions, we don't have earthbound spirits. I mean, Gettysburg, I would think that there would be, honestly, a ton of earthbound spirits dying.
There should be more. There should be 10 tons at Verdun.
Yeah. And now I'm sure that there are going to be some people out there who have gone to Gettysburg and even paranormal researchers who come up with stuff and say, well, we got this. We got that.
What
that would suggest there.
What is let them give me the context of their findings. What was the context that they found things in? If they're just going out and taking random photos, that's non-contextual. That's irrelevant, completely irrelevant. It has no context at all. Again, that's just like an archaeologist finding an arrowhead in the field. It has no significance at all, just taking random photos. And what I do, I have context because I am right there in the frame performing cultural activities, and I'm not just going out there and wearing a Civil War uniform. I really get involved, and I try different type of things, and then I try to repeat it, and I have a comparison because I have that playback of that video of that same space where nothing is occurring, and then I'm doing these activities, and something is occurring. So, and then I repeat the activity later on, doing something similar but within the same cultural frame, and it repeats itself. That suggests some type of agency. And if you're a scientific ghost researcher, i.e., you use a lot of equipment, that doesn't make it scientific
no.
at all. And I relegate that ghost gear to the background. It's just there to record me as the principal tool of investigation. Because if there is an interactive entity, I want that interactive entity to identify with me as a socially significant person, not a machine.
Right. Now, I'm with you on that. And this has also been something that I've changed in the last many months of our investigations. You know, in fact, it's been a lot more than that. It's been a good year and a half. I don't really care about pictures. I don't really care about video unless there's a meaningful reason to do it. Now, we do take pictures and video for, you know, documenting the surroundings and documenting what we're doing. But honestly, I no longer give a rat's butt about whether I get something on video or some anomaly on a picture. Why? Because it's not meaningful. It doesn't tell me anything. On the other hand, EVP, audio recordings, things like that can be quite meaningful, and to me that's the most important. And in addition to spirit communication, things like that, which is what EVP is. And so what you're talking about makes a lot of sense to me, because you're using video and photographs within a different context. It's not the primary thing. It's to document what you're doing and how you're interacting. And I think that's important for groups, because so many of the groups, you know, they watch the TV programs, let's take a bunch of pictures, let's set up the DVR system. I mean, I don't even set up a DVR system anymore unless there's a darn good reason to do it, because I just don't care. There's a lot of work, and it's what I think you said earlier on, and rewording it, is it's very little return on investment,
right?
Time investment, because you were talking about getting in 1 hour what might take 8 hours for others.
Right, because you're just sitting back and waiting for something to happen. I go out there and actually, see, I'm not the only one who's performing, because the ghost is performing too. I mean, we're all that's why I said at the beginning, we are all actors, we're all in theater, we always are performing. So maybe you might not call it performance,
mm-hmm.
but it's the same thing. They're reenacting their life
right.
within a certain cultural context.
And we're reenacting ours, or enacting.
Exactly. But what I'm trying to do is I'm trying to bring those two together. I'm trying to create a resonating element there between what they understand, what they know of their culture, and what I'm trying to do.
You're trying to build a common ground for an interactive process.
Right, interactive. We have a common ground that I'm socially identifiable as that person, that this entity wants to communicate with, because they feel that, you know,
common ground.
Yeah, like for example, if you have a, you go investigate a haunting and it's a murder, a girl was raped by a bunch of men, and you have an all male investigative team, that
mm-hmm.
entity is not going to communicate with those males.
Yep, that's a great point for our listeners. If you have any inkling of what's going on, try to choose the person who might best interact with that. Now, here's a question from the chat room.
Okay.
Have you ever had any experiences with malevolent spirits?
No.
Okay.
I think they're very, very few and far between. I still believe that what you were in life, you are in death, and that also means that if you're a ghost, and that is, you haven't crossed over, you don't have any more abilities than you did have
mm-hmm.
in life, but
mm-hmm.
you have that personality. So if you were had a really bad, nasty attitude, you might get some of that, but I would call that malevolent.
Mm-hmm.
I would just call that a
well,
a,
yeah. Well, you can have
personality.
Yeah, you can have spirits who are asses. You can have,
yeah.
I mean, there are malevolent people on the earth. I mean, you can have a malevolent human spirit, and you know, a lot of times we think of malevolent spirits as non-human.
Malevolence does not come from being a ghost. It comes
right.
from the way you were in life.
Right.
Your personality in life. You don't change, you don't increase your powers by dying and becoming a ghost.
Nor your necessarily your belief system. Well, what's your position on demons?
Whenever there, I get a lot of emails saying that, you know, related to this,
mm-hmm.
And I am not a demonologist. I know Mrs. Warren. I talked to her up at Penn State last year.
Uh-huh.
I would refer case, and she definitely says if go for an expert demonologist, a person who really is knowledgeable about.
Okay. Well, how about the existence of demons, or do you feel that that can be explained culturally?
I think if you can explain a lot of it culturally, if I'm looking at it anthropologically, most cultures in the world, apart from Western culture, believe in the existence of demons.
Okay? Yeah.
And a belief in the existence of demons is the first step toward manifesting qualities of a demon.
Yep.
Belief,
you know,
itself. I mean, like voodoo and stuff like that. If you have, you know, you go to Africa, Oceania, Polynesia, there's, you know, people die from a belief in witchcraft, from a belief in voodoo, from a
definitely
sense of voodoo. So the first step is a belief. If you have a very cultural belief in the power of that there is demons, you're gonna get something out of it. You're gonna get manifestations from that. But I think there are elementals out there that were never human to begin with.
Right, which we refer to as inhuman or non-human spirits.
I believe they are out there. I mean, and that's very, very common in Europe and European folklore. There's a
mm-hmm.
lot of sites in Europe that are sites where these elementals and these type of earth spirits are.
What?
Very, 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 very common in Europe. Your
yeah.
anthropological and folkloric point of view.
Mm-hmm.
I've done a lot of research on that too, and I believe in that stuff. But again, the belief system is very, very important. The cultural belief system. If a society, as a culture, believes in this system, it's going to work.
Okay, so go ahead.
No, I was going to say it's going to manifest.
Okay, great. So let's take just a sidebar here. Tell everybody your website.
I have two of them. www.ghostexcavator.com. That's where my books and blogs are, and some of my research is at. Let me see. It's a long one. Where do I?
Well, you looked that one, and now I have your websites posted on Paranexus under your
okay.
the article that shows you on tonight. But they can also buy your books from ghostexcavator.com.
Yeah, you can buy from ghostexcavator.com. They're on Amazon. They're on in Borders, Barnes & Nobles. you know, throughout, in, you can just go on the internet and type books in, and you can get them anywhere.
Sure.
I guess if you go, if you really want to do it, go on Amazon, because there's like each one of them has at least 20 different sellers, and the prices range from, I think the normal price, for example, goes like $3 to $16.50, but there's a range from $25 down to about $9. So
right.
I'd buy the $9 book. If I were you, why pay $16 or why pay $25 when you can pay $9?
Okay. Right, here's, go ahead.
I was going to say, we were talking about that cultural belief system. One
mm-hmm.
thing I want to mention that I just thought of is the idea of tulpas.
Oh, say again?
The idea of tulpas, T-U-L-P-A-S.
Can you explain that?
Okay, what I think is going on in Gettysburg, especially among reenactors have this thing called wargasm.
They called what?
Wargasm. Have you never heard of that?
No.
They have wargasm. And they have this wargasm. They really get so involved in something that they have a wargasm. That they really believe that they're part of that culture and they're that part of a thing. So they can't be objective in the first place because they believe they're actually.
Well, they're predisposed.
But what a tulpa is they practice yoga. A lot of reenactors practice yoga and all these kind of meditation techniques. Tulpas are physical manifestations of a very, very concentrated belief in something. So if you're out there as a Civil War reenactor and you're reliving the part of a Civil War reenactor, you have so concentrated on that belief and on that character, and if so many people are doing it at the same time, that belief system could physically manifest as a tulpa, which maybe is why some of these soldiers see these soldiers walking around for a few seconds and disappear. That's a tulpa.
All right, well, here's a question from the chat room. They would like to know about your work in the Yucatan.
I worked as a cultural anthropologist. Actually, it was very, very interesting. It was in the 70s, and at that time, there was nothing. There was no resource in the Yucatan. There was no Cancun or Cozumel. There was like, I stayed in one hotel on the island of Cozumel that cost me about $2 a night. I was like one of the only few Americans there, and it was just great exploring that whole coast, looking for archaeological sites, doing archaeological surveys, doing ethnographic work among the Maya Indians. It's just great. No tourists at all, hardly any tourists. And I also worked in Chiapas and in Tabasco. The state of Chiapas and Tabasco. There's a famous archaeological site in Tabasco called Palenque. I worked there too in the jungle. But what was really interesting one time is I went from San Cristobal de las Casas in Tabasco to Villahermosa. San Cristobal de las Casas in Chiapas to Villahermosa in Tabasco. It's about 150 miles over the mountains. It took us 23 hours to travel 150 miles because we went over the mountains in a torrential downpour, and there was no road. It was all dirt, and there was nothing, and there was no barriers or anything. We were driving like 5 miles an hour through these mountain roads, and I was on the hood of the car with these big flashlights because we couldn't see 10 feet in front of it. Great experience. Great experience. You know, that was when I was young and dumb. I don't do that stuff.
So were you able to find anything?
Yeah, I found a lot of sites in the jungle. Walking around Palenque, you have the unearthed part of it where the tourists would go. But I had some guides that lived in the jungle, and they would take me out to some of these unexplored areas. I met with some Lacandon Indians who still live in the forest. And it's interesting that if anybody out there in the audience chews gum, I would like to thank you very, very much, because it's the chicleros, the people who go out and get the sap from the chicle tree that you make chewing gum out of. The chicleros were the ones who discovered many, many, many archaeological sites deep down there in the jungle, and they brought archaeologists back. So all you chewing gum people out there, thank you very much.
Okay, the same person, Sharon, wants to know, any work at, I believe, I'm not sure how to pronounce this, is it Chichen Itza?
Chichen Itza. Yeah, I was at Chichen Itza at the sacred well again in the 70s. I never went into the well, but I was there. I wasn't there. There's an interesting stelae at Chichen that depicts all nine planets. Very, you know, and the stelae is what? I think it's the classic period, so we're talking about 1,500 years old or something like that. But it has all nine planets aligned.
Interesting.
The Mayans were very, very... And, of course, some will say, well, that's because ancient astronauts came down and told them where they were. But I don't believe that.
What do you believe?
I don't believe in ancient astronauts. I believe the Mayan culture did it itself.
How were they able to see, like, Pluto, Uranus, Neptune?
I don't know. We don't know that yet.
All right.
I mean, they're just beginning to decipher the codices. The Mayan hieroglyphics.
All right, so you had an area you wanted to venture into that we talked about during the break.
Yeah, I have a couple things I wanted to say, the differences between... what I'm interested in also is the architecture of haunted space, and that's especially its phenomenological aspects. That is the embodied experience and the performances at historic sites. And what I'm interested in is the way a site is defined not only by human perception of the sensory experiences, but also the physicality of the material fabric. And if we're talking about the material fabric, we're getting into like stone tapping theory and the idea of infrasound. A lot of archaeologists now are saying that a lot of infrasound was very, very important to a lot of ancient archaeological sites and monuments, especially in Europe. So I'm interested in the idea of infrasound, because infrasound is something that you cannot detect by the human ear. And it's very, very low frequency sound, but it has an effect on the brain where you hallucinate. So it's interesting that if you're looking at some infrasound is very, very common in a lot of megalithic sites in Europe and in England. Now, I don't know how influential infrasound is. Victor Tandy talked about that. Infrasound was inducing hallucinations, i.e. manifestations of hauntings in some buildings. That's a very, very interesting sidelight. So I'm interested in that physicality of the material fabric. Also the idea of water, how water retains memory. That's the whole idea of homeopathic medicine, that 95% of the medicine is water, and they put some stuff in it, and because the water retains that substance.
And just to clarify, infrasound is that a frequency too low to be heard by human ears.
Right.
Okay. Yeah.
Very, 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 very low. And a lot of the megalithic monuments in Europe have this infrasonic effect, and it was used in their rituals. In their performing rituals, to induce, like for example, the druids and stuff like that, to induce supernatural abilities, supposed supernatural abilities through this infrasonic. It's just the way they were structured, the way that the stones were structured and stuff like that. And then you have the stone theory. You know, that's another thing too, that residual energies are retained in
stone tape.
Stone tape theory.
Yeah.
Now, it's interesting that at Gettysburg, in a triangular field where a lot of activity is going on. Oh, by the way, Patrick Burke is going to be on your show in August.
Mm-hmm.
Patrick Burke has a great video. Ask him about his video. Has a great video of the triangular field. He's shooting a Sony night shot up at his brother, up toward the triangular field, up toward the top of the triangular field by a stone wall. So he's filming up there. And all of a sudden, out of this stone wall comes this soldier. I mean, full-bodied apparition. Comes
really?
And starts walking up the hill. I mean, he is so identifiable that you can identify the Georgia regiment that he was affiliated with. That's how clear this soldier is. Well, you can see through him.
All right, so now what do you make of that, according to your...
That's a residual.
Okay.
Because, I mean, it didn't interact. The man was, I mean, his brother was right next to him, and the soldier didn't react to him being right there. So he just kept on walking up. That was a residual energy.
So how does that compare?
About it.
Yeah, well, how does that compare to your cultural anthropological
Well, what's interesting, well, when I was talking about the idea of water and stone, in the triangular field where this apparition, or where this residual apparition was, is it's very, very thin soil, and it's all quartz, which emits a lot of high EMF.
Mm-hmm.
And when that place gets wet, it tends to give off hallucinations. So if people say triangular field is very, very hot, one, batteries drain. Well, batteries drain because it's high EMF. It's high EMF because of the soil. It's very, very thin. It's very, very moist, and also because of the quartz and stuff like that. So the high EMF is causing the drain of the batteries, not spirit energy or ghost energy or anything like that. But also, people are sensing a lot of presences in the triangular field. Well, that's due to the high EMF causing hallucinatory experiences. So you got to watch that stuff. And you have to watch when you're doing the investigation, because the day when there's a lot of moisture in the air, i.e. before a thunderstorm or after a thunderstorm, that just creates even more effect. So if people are out there at night after a thunderstorm, you have high moisture in the air, you're going out shooting photographs, and you may be hallucinating, seeing stuff, hearing stuff, when all it is due to high EMF. So you got to watch that. Again, context is important. So you just don't go walk out into the field even after a thunderstorm. Some people say before a thunderstorm it's very conducive to spirit ghost activity because of all the energy.
Sure.
You got to watch that. You got to watch that. Depends on where you go, especially in the triangular field, because that causes a lot of residual problems.
So how does the residual concept of a ghost fit in with the cultural explanation, or does it?
Yeah, well, what is manifesting in residual energy is, for example, if you're on a Civil War battlefield, you're not going to see a residual energy of a Renaissance person dressed in a Renaissance costume, Renaissance clothes, right? So
yeah.
What's being retained there is the context of the culture of that time period. So on a Civil War battlefield, you're seeing Civil War soldiers, so the residual energy of Civil War soldiers.
Okay, so
again, that's cultural for you. So you're not seeing something that's not culturally contextual in a place. So you're not seeing a Roman soldier at Gettysburg. And you're not seeing a Civil War soldier in Italy. Why is that? Because, again, the residual is contextual, culturally contextual. Not just contextual, culturally contextual.
Okay, so what you're saying then is that, for example, let's take that video with the soldier walking out of the wall, the apparition.
Right. Right.
Okay, it took that form because of cultural influences versus...
Well,
that it was real.
I wouldn't say cultural influences, but cultural appearances. Okay, cultural influences. It can't be cultural influences because it's a residual energy. It's not interactive, so it can't be influenced by the culture. But it's understandable from a cultural perspective because that's where that battle. That's where that Georgia regiment fought. During the Battle of Gettysburg.
Okay, so the residuals are what they are.
Right.
But
they're also anchored by the cultural context. So again, you're not going to find a Roman soldier at Gettysburg. You're only going to find a Civil War soldier, and that's the cultural context.
Okay, so what I'm having a hard time understanding is, you know, if I understand you correctly, you're saying that we understand that soldier was a soldier because of the cultural context. Does that mean that the soldier wasn't necessarily a soldier, it was just an apparition, but yet we saw it as such because of the cultural context?
No, I don't think so, because he was specifically identified with a specific Georgia regiment by what he was wearing.
Okay, so the apparition is what it was.
It was identified. It was so clear. I've seen the original tape. On his website, he has a copy of that tape, so you could see it coming. You could see him coming out of the wall, but it's no comparison to seeing it live.
Okay, so how? So how does a residual that is truly a residual of a Confederate soldier, how would cultural aspects affect seeing it or what it is?
Cultural aspects from the investigator's point of view,
or anybody who saw it. Yeah, I mean maybe I'm just misunderstanding you, but
yeah, I mean, well, first of all, an investigator would have to know the culture of the Civil War, you know, understand the uniforms of the Civil War.
Sure.
In order to understand the cultural context of what he's seeing or what she is seeing.
I got you now. Okay, so what we're saying, just in case anybody else is confused like me, what we're saying here, and correct me if I'm wrong, that the residual was a Confederate soldier. It is what it was. But it, and that really, the fact is that we're not going to see a Roman soldier because, well, there weren't Roman soldiers there.
Exactly. So actually what the residual is the energy field of an individual who was actually there. So, I mean, if I don't know how, you can ask Patrick on this. I don't know how detailed it is, but I don't know if you can get down to very specifics. You can identify the regiment, the Georgia regiment that this residual fought at. But I don't know if you can get down even more specific to individuality.
All right. So from the chat room, so in other words, we see that image because of our memory. Does that mean that if we have no reference, and I can't read it all, but that would appear amorphously or appear without context?
Well, for example, one, you identify with the place that it was a Civil War site. So one, you're presupposing that if you got a residual manifestation there, it would have to. Well, not it might. No. I changed my mind on that because you got multiple stratigraphic levels there, multiple cultural horizons there. So you would have to know that this is what that a Civil War soldier looked like, and then you would have to do research and say, okay, what type of Civil War soldier is this, Union or Confederate? Then what regiment he is, because you know we have the land there. It wasn't only occupied during the Civil War. It's been occupied, so you have probably, and that's the whole idea of the symmetry of space, you have multiple occupational levels there,
mm-hmm.
and a ghost excavator would dig down each of those layers and use specific cultural inducements, i.e. target activities, target objects, to try to target that particular cultural horizon.
Gotcha.
So if I was at the triangular field and I wanted to get a Civil War manifestation, I would cultural inducements of the Civil War. But that does not negate that there are other residual energies there. And to get those, to dig down even deeper to get those other residual energies, I would have to use other performative activities.
So you're relating it to archaeology. You dig down so far, you get a certain era. You dig deeper,
right.
You get a different era. You dig deeper,
right.
You get an older era.
It's called cultural stratigraphy.
Okay.
So that's the whole idea of multiple paths in the same space. That's the idea of symmetry. And that's the reason why you just don't set up your equipment and wait for something to happen. If you really want to know the context of the haunting, be it residual or interactive, you have to perform within the cultural horizon you are trying to get to manifest. So at that particular space, you might have five different residual energies there. Well, not residual energies, but you would have five. You might have five different interactive presences there.
Mm-hmm.
And what you're trying to do is target a particular cultural
mm-hmm.
horizon to get that particular manifestation because of the multiple paths that are
right.
occurring there.
Gotcha.
The residual energy there, you might be, maybe, now, you can't control the residual energy. Well, maybe you can control because of physical factors occurring there that will manifest the physical energy. I don't know what those law-like generalizations are, why a residual would manifest. What would be more interesting for me is what type of residual energy is manifesting at a particular time. Now, why was it a Civil War residual energy manifesting at that time? Why was it an earlier or a later residual energy manifesting at that particular time? That is the interesting question, not if it was a residual energy or not. Why was it that particular residual energy if you have multiple paths occurring in the same space? That's an interesting question.
Okay, cool. So now, is there another area you wanted to get into? We've got less than 10 minutes left, and I have one question to go into, but I want to make sure we've got time for everything.
Okay, so what I wanted to say was, like I said, I was interested in the idea of haunted space. Now, to me, the haunted space is an engaging story about time, space, context, and understanding. Now, this engagement is an excavation, and it's dependent upon, this is what I was just talking about, therefore, dependent upon a selective erasure of elements of architecture and presence. So we are targeting a specific performance to try to get a particular cultural ghost to manifest. So we're trying to be selective and erase those other elements and focus on one particular element during that performance.
Interesting.
That's very, very important. So what we have at any one location is a stratigraphy of human histories, and those human histories could be residual or interactive, and they're all performance-based. The residual energy is a performance culturally based, and also the interactive is a performance culturally based.
So the way you go about it is going to target one of those layers.
I could target one of the layers and maybe go in and target another layer, but I would use a different script and a different performance using different target activities and different target objects. So
gotcha. It's
multiple excavations. It's just not sitting there, again, it's not sitting there passively setting up my equipment for 8 hours and then playing it back and see if something comes up.
Mm-hmm.
Ridiculous. Absolutely ridiculous.
All right, cool. So let me ask you this question. This is from the chat room now. Let me scroll up a bit. Here's the question. Would someone who believes in UFOs then see spirits as aliens?
I don't believe in UFOs, so I don't know. But if you're taking it my logic, if now, for example, that logic would mean that if I believe in Gettysburg ghosts, then I see Gettysburg ghosts. Is that the logic?
Something on that order.
Yes. Well, actually, I don't believe in anything until I can prove it reiteratively various times. Well, I won't even begin to have the possibility that I might believe in something unless I can make it reiterative in a performative practice. So saying that if I believe in UFOs, will I see UFO ghosts? That's completely an irrelevant question for me. I'm not saying it's an irrelevant question, but it's an irrelevant question for me from the way I do investigations.
Okay, so just to follow up now, I think there's a follow-up question from a different person. I believe it's referring to UFOs. You said you don't believe in UFOs, and the question I believe is why not?
Well, I don't believe in UFOs the way they are mediated.
Presented?
The way they are mediated, i.e. the way they are being portrayed in the literature. I believe that there is extraterrestrial life on other planets, but I don't believe in the mediation of the UFO phenomenon the way it's being mediated, the way it's being represented.
Okay.
In literature, in research, in design, and stuff like that. So I don't believe in the way it's being representative. That's not necessarily mean I don't believe in it, but I don't believe in the way it's being representative.
Okay, cool. So just to reiterate, if I can sum up what we've been talking about for the last couple hours, ghost excavation if we think of it in terms of an archaeological excavation, what you're doing is you are, in essence, going down to a specific layer, because in archaeology, different layers represent different eras, different time frames. So you are looking at excavating or going to a specific layer to see what might be there. And in so doing, you're using tools, language, different things of that era to, in an effort to attract or to bring out the ghost that might be there.
To resonate with, that, with those cultural values of that ghost. I could summarize it in this way, for example. The excavation is more than an archaeological metaphor. An archaeologist excavates what remains of a completed past. A ghost excavator unearths the fragmented remains of a still incomplete past. That means what's left underneath what's left.
Okay. Very good. Well, listen, it's been a fascinating couple of hours. I really appreciate you taking your time and expressing some of this. I know I've been looking forward to it since we talked. And if you'd like to know more, please visit John's website, ghostexcavator.com. Right, John?
That's right.
Okay, and you've got books out, six books anyway.
Six books. I've already started the seventh and eighth.
Good for you.
Good.
So, and we're trying to hook up John as a presenter at the Paranexus conference. So this is just a real quick opportunity to talk about Paranexus. If you're not a member, please go visit paranexus.org. We have a conference coming up in Tampa in October of this year. We've got a great lineup of speakers. We're getting more. And it's just going to be an excellent time. It starts a Thursday night, the 23rd. We've got Friday and Saturday full days of presenters, workshops, and great educational opportunities. And then it ends up Sunday morning, Friday night. We're going to have the Paranexus Challenge, where we have a couple of teams or so going to a top secret location, and it's going to be video broadcast to the group live. We're going to have the Spirits and Shadows costume ball on Saturday night for a little bit of fun, mixed in with the networking opportunities. Great place to meet old friends, make new ones. So take a look at Paranexus.org. We do have charter memberships available right now for 6 months for $5. That's going to be going up in the next few weeks. So take advantage of that. We've got some great evidence there, some interesting stuff going on that you can't see if you're not a member. So it's a great place to share as well. John, thanks so much for taking your time. Really appreciate you being here tonight.
I'm glad to be here.
And next week, we will be talking with Eric Altman from the Pennsylvania Bigfoot Society. We'll be talking about some cryptozoological issues and topics. So hopefully you'll be able to join us then. With that, we appreciate everybody listening in. Appreciate your questions. Appreciate your time as well. And hopefully we'll see you next week. Have a good week, folks.
Paranexus Universe.